Welcome back. This is VOA Asia Weekend. From Washington, D.C., Ari Arifin for Ira Melman with a look back to the past week of news and feature stories that made up our daily VOA Asia program. And now with the top story of the week, we turn to Jim Stevenson, who has more on the explosions in Sri Lanka.
In the deadliest violence in Sri Lanka in a decade, multiple explosions ripped through churches and luxury hotels on Easter Sunday, leaving more than 200 dead and more than 400 others wounded. Sri Lanka has imposed a curfew effective immediately and blocked access to major social media and messaging apps to prevent the spread of misinformation and rumors in the wake of the blasts. Marcus Harton brings us this report from Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi.
The first six blasts that began around 8:45 local time were coordinated and claimed most of the fatalities, while two smaller blasts took place several hours later. The capital, Colombo, where three major hotels and one church were targeted, bore the brunt of the mayhem. Christian groups have said they face increasing intimidation from hardline Buddhist monks in recent years. However, such harassment is on a relatively minor level, says Jahan Pereira, who heads the National Peace Council in Colombo.
Who would target Catholics? There has been anti-Christian sentiment, but it's on a very small scale with regard to these little conversions that are happening in different localities, but not to the extent where people were being killed.
Condemnation of the deadly bombings came in from leaders across the world, including U.S. President Donald Trump. For reporter Anjana Pasricha, this is Marcus Harton, VOA News, Washington.
Officials say seven people have been detained in connection with the blasts. The Associated Press quotes a security official as saying two of the blasts may have been carried out by suicide bombers. Authorities say one of the churches, St. Anthony's, and all of the hotels hit by the first blasts were in Colombo. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attacks. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "Heartfelt condolences from the people of the United States to the people of Sri Lanka on the horrible terrorist attacks on churches and hotels. We stand ready to help." Several world and religious leaders condemn the deadly explosions. Dozens of foreigners, British, Dutch, and American citizens are believed to be among the dead. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo condemned the blast in the strongest terms and confirmed U.S. citizens were among those killed. He said, "We stand with the Sri Lankan government and people as they confront violent extremism and have offered our assistance as they work to bring the perpetrators to justice." The World Jewish Congress denounced the attack as heinous and appealed for zero tolerance to those who use terror to advance their objectives. Pope Francis expressed closeness to the Christian community struck by the attacks in Sri Lanka on Easter Day. In his Easter message, he also prayed for peace in Syria, Yemen, Libya, and South Sudan. The pontiff addressed tens of thousands of pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square from the central balcony of the Basilica. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Under gray skies, but in a St. Peter's Square filled with flowers, Pope Francis, dressed in white vestments, celebrated Easter Mass in front of tens of thousands of faithful and tourists. At the end of the Mass, the Pope gave his traditional message and blessing to the city and to the world. His last words before he wished everyone a happy Easter were for the people of Sri Lanka, struck, he said, by the serious attacks on Easter Day, which brought mourning and pain in some of the churches and other sites in the country. He said he learned the news with sadness and expressed closeness to the Christian community gathered in prayer. Earlier in his message, the Pope said, "The resurrection of Christ is the principle of new life for every man and every woman, for true renewal always begins from the heart, from the conscience. Yet Easter," the Pope added, "is also the beginning of the new world set free from the slavery of sin and death." The Pope's first thoughts went to the people of Syria, victims of an ongoing conflict to which we risk becoming ever more resigned and even indifferent. He urged a new commitment for a political solution that will respond for the hopes for peace and confront the humanitarian crisis. The Pope's thoughts also turned to the people of Yemen, especially the children, exhausted by hunger and war, and to the situation in Libya.
Le armi cessino di insanguinare la Libia,
The Pope said, may conflict and bloodshed cease in Libya, where defenseless people are once more dying in recent weeks and many families have been forced to abandon their homes. Pope Francis urged the parties involved to choose dialogue over force and to avoid reopening wounds left by a decade of conflicts and political instability. The Pope also prayed for peace in other parts of the African continent, which he said is still rife with social tensions, conflicts, and at times violent forms of extremism that leave in their wake insecurity, destruction, and death. He mentioned Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon. But he also spoke of Sudan, which he said is presently experiencing a moment of political uncertainty. Referring to the recent spiritual retreat held with South Sudanese leaders in the Vatican, the Pope expressed the hope for a new page open in the history of that country, in which all political, social, and religious components actively commit themselves to the pursuit of the common good and the reconciliation of the nation. The Pope also mentioned the crisis in Venezuela and the situation in Nicaragua, where he expressed hope for a peaceful, negotiated solution. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News. Rome.
We invite you to read more on our top story as it continues to develop by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo dismissed a statement from a senior North Korean foreign ministry official saying that the country no longer wants to deal with him if dialogue with the U.S. resumes. Pompeo said he is still in charge of the U.S. negotiating team and that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has promised to denuclearize half a dozen times. The exchange came amid a flurry of diplomatic activity prior to the summit between Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reported from the State Department.
Nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea have stalled since a February summit between Kim and President Donald Trump ended without a deal. North Korea's official KNCA news agency quoted a senior foreign ministry official saying, I wish our dialogue counterpart would not be Pompeo, but another person who is more careful and mature in communicating with us. After meeting with his Japanese counterpart at the State Department Friday, Pompeo brushed off the report.
Nothing changed. We're continuing to work to negotiate. I'm still in charge of the team. President Trump's obviously in charge of the overall effort, but it'll be my team.
Amid the diplomatic impasse, South Korean President Moon Jae-in is pushing for another inter-Korean summit with Kim Jong-un to revive the nuclear talks. Analysts say the U.S. would welcome this. Dennis Wilder of Georgetown University.
I think this is a moment where actually the Trump administration is eager to have Moon play a role, because since the summit in Hanoi, the North Koreans really have gone silent in the American channels. The New York channel, other channels are not really operating right now.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is set to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin for the first time next week. Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, visited Russia twice, meeting with Putin in 2002. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The UN Refugee Agency calls a new training project in Cox's Bazar a potential game changer for local Bangladeshi and Rohingya refugee women who are learning potentially money-making skills. The UNHCR, which is supporting this project, has teamed up with a local NGO, the Aisha Abed Foundation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR's headquarters in Geneva.
The program aims to provide income opportunities to hundreds of impoverished women by teaching them skills in craft production. The project, which began in February, is now being scaled up. The UN Refugee Agency says the goal is to train 500 women by the end of the year. Half that number will comprise Rohingya refugee women, and the other half will be women chosen from among the Bangladesh communities hosting them. The UNHCR reports the women will receive a small stipend during the training period. If the project is successful, it says it hopes to expand it to include hundreds more women. The camps in Cox's Bazar hold more than 750,000 Rohingya refugees, most of whom fled to Bangladesh to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar in August 2017. UNHCR spokeswoman Liz Throssell agrees the number of women enrolled in the training project represents only a tiny fraction of the vast refugee population. But she tells VOA the worth of the project should not be based on numbers alone.
Small numbers, yes, but you have to start somewhere. It is providing income sources to these women. It is providing training. And as we've underscored, we are hoping that this will be expanded. So it is offering income sources both for the local community and for the refugees.
Throssell says the local and refugee women are being taught different skills. She says local Bangladeshi women are learning silkscreen, block printing, and tailoring techniques. The refugee women in the camps, she says, are being taught to produce a variety of hand-sewn embroidery pieces. She notes most of the Rohingya refugee women in the program are widows or single mother households aged between 18 and 40. None, she says, have had any previous sewing experience. The items produced by the women will be sold in one of Bangladesh's best-known retail outlets. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, how the Mueller Reports is playing out the U.S. politics with the upcoming race for the White House already in full swing. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
The Voice of America.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. As political posturing begins for the 2020 U.S. presidential election, Democrats in the U.S. Congress have formally demanded a full, unredacted copy of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Release of the report has split Washington and much of the country into two camps. Republican supporters of President Donald Trump, who says he was cleared of wrongdoing, and Democrats alarmed by the numerous instances of possible obstruction of justice involving the president outlined in the report. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the political fallout from Washington.
Following the release of the Mueller report, President Donald Trump greeted excited supporters in Florida. The president has a lot to be happy about, says spokeswoman Sarah Sanders.
There was no collusion, which is what the entire investigation was supposed to be about.
Trump says the Mueller report exonerated him both on the question of collusion with Russia and on the issue of obstruction of justice.
This should never happen to another president again. This hoax, this should never happen to another president again.
But on the issue of obstruction, the special counsel's report tells a different story, detailing numerous attempts by Trump to influence the investigation. Trump's actions may not result in legal action, but they are troubling, says California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff.
They are unquestionably dishonest, unethical, immoral, and unpatriotic, and should be condemned by every American. That is not the subject of vindication. That is the subject of condemnation.
For some Democrats, the contents of the Mueller report are enough already to warrant impeachment proceedings against the president, including Congressman Al Green of Texas.
Mr. Mueller has done his job. It is now time for Congress to do its job.
But for Trump supporters like Rich George in Michigan, the results of the Mueller probe have lifted a cloud hanging over the White House.
Now that he's been, in my mind, exonerated by this very expensive investigation, he's super free and clear, in my mind.
What happens next is up to Congress, says former independent counsel Robert Ray.
Where do we go from here? The only other place to go is an impeachment proceeding, and the question then will be, as a political matter, whether Democrats are prepared to travel down that road.
Democrats are split on whether to impeach Trump, but they do appear committed to holding him accountable, says analyst David Abraham.
How much shifting in popular sentiment will result from this is hard to say, but our leaders in Congress and elsewhere have an obligation to the people of the United States to pursue this until the truth is fully revealed.
Thank you, everybody.
The report and how voters see the conclusions will undoubtedly be part of the upcoming 2020 presidential election campaign, says Jim Kessler.
Russia is not going to take them out in this election. It's going to be on more traditional things. And the Democrats need to nominate somebody who can beat Donald Trump, which is probably someone who's more in the pragmatic progressive area than in the far left area.
For the moment, Trump is content to take a victory lap and celebrate on Twitter. But the lingering questions about obstruction of justice are likely to follow him all through next year's presidential campaign. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. We now go back to where everything began, we think, as VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
Until the stars began to form, the only atoms in the early universe were mostly of hydrogen, some helium, and trace amounts of lithium and beryllium. Scientists theorize that about 100,000 years after the Big Bang, elements of helium and hydrogen atoms formed the first molecule in the universe, helium hydride. While many think the molecule should exist in parts of our universe, it was never detected until recently. In a new study published in the journal Nature, scientists say they were able to detect the signature of the first molecule in the universe in a planetary nebula 3,000 light-years away near the constellation Cygnus. The discovery was made by the scientists who used sophisticated instruments that were aboard NASA's Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, or SOFIA, the world's largest airborne observatory. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. For some, the launch of a rocket into space to resupply the International Space Station has become a routine mission. But for a group of students working with the Adler Planetarium in Chicago, it's a historic moment marking the achievement of a lifetime. Our story lifts off from Chicago, where VOA's Kane Farabaugh has more.
19-year-old college student Fatima Guerra will be the first to admit she's into some really nerdy stuff.
Like, up there, nerdy.
Way up there, nerdy, in fact. All the way up into space. Guerra is an astronomer in training, involved since high school with a small project at the Adler Planetarium with big goals.
So our main goal was to see if the ozone layer is getting thinner and by how much, if there's like different parts of the Earth's atmosphere that's getting thinner because of the pollution.
A small electronic device called ThinSat gathers the data to shed light on these questions. Designed to orbit the Earth, the device was not developed by highly paid engineers, but by Chicago area students like Guerra.
We focused on coding the different parts of like sensors that the ThinSat is composed of. So we coded so that it can measure light intensity, pressure.
Yeah, this stuff is very nerdy.
Jesus Garcia is a systems engineer for the Adler Planetarium's Far Horizons project and oversees the work of the students developing ThinSat.
Many of the students who gain these opportunities are not typically from under-income or minority students. In fact, here at the Adler, we have students who are minorities, who have been faced with challenges of not having opportunities presented to them. And here we are presenting a mission where they are collaborating with us, scientists and engineers, to work on our very first mission that's going to space.
When NASA's Antares rocket, built by Northrop Grumman, blasted off from the coast of Virginia on April 17th, it wasn't just making a resupply mission to the International Space Station. On board was ThinSat, the culmination of work by many at the Adler, including Fatima Guerra, who joined the Far Horizons team as a high school requirement that became so much more.
The requirement can really become like a life-changing opportunity, and you don't even know it. It's really exciting to see that my work is going to go up into space and help in the scientific world.
It is also exciting for her parents, immigrants from Guatemala, who can proudly say their daughter helped build a satellite orbiting the Earth.
They are really excited, especially when I told them that it might become like a worldwide type of news and I'm going to be a part of it. They were really proud and they were calling my family over there and like, oh, she might be on TV. It's something that they feel really proud of me about for achieving.
Long after ThinSat's work is done, Guerra will still be known as a member of a team that put the first satellite developed by a private planetarium into space. She says her friends don't think that's nerdy at all. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Sri Lanka is invoking emergency powers in the aftermath of the devastating coordinated bombings which turned Eastern Sunday festivities into a national tragedy in Sri Lanka, killing at least 290 people and wounding more than 500 others. The 9 blasts mainly targeted churches and luxury hotels in the country's deadliest violence since its civil war ended a decade ago. The blasts destroyed ceilings and blew out windows. People carried victims of blood-spattered pews. Police says 13 suspects have been arrested. Alan Keenan is the International Crisis Group's Sri Lanka senior analyst. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with him via Skype from London.
It's really come as a shock. There was never any history of violence of this sort against Christians, and certainly not by any by the Muslim group that the government is claiming is responsible for this. There's been no history of Islamic militancy within Sri Lanka. And indeed, Muslims have been extremely restrained as a community in the face of severe violence that they have been suffering the last 5 or 6 years from groups of Sinhalese Buddhists who say that they're defending the Buddhist character of the country against the supposed Islamic threat. So it all came out of nowhere, really, it seems.
So I take it this leads to the assumptions that are being made that this comes from not only internal sources, but international sources, correct?
Right. That's why I think a lot of people have turned elsewhere to look for the source of this violence, which is not to let the, you know, if indeed those the government has arrested are responsible, obviously they need to be held to account. But it does seem that they must have been working with others with the kind of experience and technical capability to pull off these outrageously violent attacks.
Now, this is not to say that Sri Lanka does not have a history of violence.
Indeed. And that's sort of the paradox here, because when everyone woke up to these terrible attacks, the assumption was they must have come from one of the many existing or past lines of conflict in Sri Lanka. And Sri Lanka has seen terrible political violence. It saw 30 years of civil war between government forces and the Tamil Tigers, who were demanding a separate Tamil state in the north and east of the island. It has seen uprisings by Sinhalese from the majority community, leftist nationalist Sinhalese in the 1970s and 1980s, where tens of thousands of people died. It has seen mob attacks against Muslims quite recently by these Buddhist militant groups. It has seen also attacks, sort of lower scale, lower level attacks on Christian churches, on principally evangelical Christian churches by militant Buddhist groups as well. So, I mean, it's had lots of violence. It's had political assassinations, massacres, enforced disappearances. I mean, it's had a terrible history. It's still standing. And for them, you know, 10 years after the end of the Civil War, for this new form of violence to emerge has really shocked and depressed and scared a lot of people. I work for a conflict resolution and prevention and mitigation organization, and so I'm always trying to think ahead to what might come next and how potential future violence could be prevented or reduced. So what worries me are the consequences of this violence on the fragile and tense relationships between the different communities in Sri Lanka. So particularly, as I was saying, there has been this campaign, which has often taken violent forms, against Muslims, presenting them in Sri Lanka as a threat to the island, to its political stability, to the Buddhist character of the island. And until now, there's really been no tangible evidence that there is any kind of physical threat from Muslims to anybody else, because Muslims have been a very calm, conservative minority who knew that if they cause trouble, they would suffer more than anybody else. So they've been very restrained in responding to the attacks on them. But now we actually do have what appears to be a direct and quite severe act of violence by at least some Sri Lankan Muslims. So the worry is this will be used to justify further and perhaps even worse attacks on Sri Lanka, on Sri Lankan Muslims, or simply, you know, people will be angry. Perhaps some Christians will be angry at what's happened to them and their loved ones. So I think levels of volatility, political volatility, were already quite high in Sri Lanka. And there has been this long history of violence, which may not explain these attacks, but sets a context in which these attacks could provoke or be used to justify further violence. So it's absolutely essential that government leaders, business leaders, and crucially religious leaders from all the main communities work together to caution people against holding the entire Muslim community responsible for what may have been, and I again say may have been, the acts of a small number of their community.
The reports that we have all heard over the past 24 hours or so are saying that there might have been a tip coming from Indian intelligence that was not picked up upon. What do you know about that, if anything?
Well, I know what's been in, what's been published. There was a briefing, an internal sort of report by the Deputy Inspector General of Police to some of his senior colleagues, including the political leadership, reporting this warning, which appears to have come from Indian intelligence sources, that there would be a plan of suicide attacks on churches and apparently also potentially on the Indian High Commission in Colombo. The problem was this report came just as Sri Lanka was about to enjoy its long New Year break about 10 days ago. So it may have sort of just fallen through the cracks of everyone going home on vacation, but it probably also suffered from the deep divisions within the government between the president, who holds the portfolio of defense and law and order, which means he's in charge of the entire security apparatus, including the police and intelligence agencies. And on the other side, the prime minister from a different party, whom the president hates and tried to get rid of through unconstitutional means in the end of last year, which caused quite a constitutional crisis. So we know that the government is deeply divided and apparently dysfunctional not only on other policies, which has been pointed out many times, but perhaps also on security issues, which has led to a lot of people being afraid of what could be coming next if the government doesn't get its act together.
That was VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Alan Keenan, the International Crisis Group's Sri Lanka senior analyst. You're tuned in to VOA Asia Weekend. Our next story shares with us about how misinformation spreads in Taiwan. Jim Stevenson has more.
A Taiwan television network quoted a farmer last month saying the price of pomelos was so low last year that he threw 1.2 million kilograms of the grapefruit-like produce into a reservoir. Taiwan's National Communications Commission says the farmer actually sold his fruit. Last year, the government protested news reports, saying Taiwan's office in Osaka had not arranged to rescue Taiwanese tourists stranded at a typhoon-flooded Japanese airport. Japanese authorities had closed off the airport, the government here said, just to about all of unnecessary traffic. And cases such as these prompted the government to approve a series of draft legal changes aimed at stopping the spread of misinformation. The laws, more often found in authoritarian Asian states rather than the region's democracies, are expected to discipline Taiwan's freewheeling news outlets along with social media. Social media scholars like Ku Lin Lin, associate journalism professor at National Taiwan University, says the revised laws could instill more trust in a society already divided over major issues, such as ties with political rival China. But deciding what reports constitute fake news may fall into the hands of government officials worried about the next election, she says. And quick prosecution would give the government an upper hand in controlling the media.
I think the administration wants to create more, like you can say, tools or weapons to attack or counterattack fake news, they need something to penalize the media. They need something more concrete.
But on the definition of fake news, Ku says that these laws give a very clear message to the people that the government has the final say. Taiwan's ruling party-dominated parliament must approve the legal revisions before they take effect. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. As we observed World Immunization Week, we're going to focus on a disease that could be eradicated from the earth, just like smallpox was. And as just as international programs are doing with polio. But instead, as we hear from Carol Pearson, this potentially deadly disease is making a comeback.
Measles is a disease that is found only in humans, so it could be completely wiped off the face of the earth, just like smallpox was. But despite a highly effective and safe vaccine, measles is making a comeback. In just the first 3 months of this year, the World Health Organization reports that cases of measles has tripled over last year. In Africa, the situation is worse. Africa saw a 700% increase compared to last year.
Madagascar has almost 1,000 deaths. It has, you know, tens of thousands of infections.
This is Brooklyn, New York, where a measles outbreak among Hasidic Jews prompted the mayor to declare a state of emergency. The National Institutes of Health warns that a decline in measles vaccination is causing a preventable global resurgence of this often deadly disease, including in the U.S. Before the vaccine became available in the 1960s, about 2 million people around the world would die from measles. In the U.S., 3 to 4 million people were infected every year.
1 in 10 children who get infected with measles will get an ear infection that could cause deafness. 1 in 20 would get pneumonia. 1 in 1,000 would get brain swelling, what we call encephalitis. And 1 to 3 per 1,000 would die. So to say that measles is a trivial disease is completely incorrect.
The complications are even worse in poor countries.
You start off with children who are already at greater risk. They may be malnourished. They may have immune system compromise. They may have underweight, and they may have no access to health care. So measles is a big killer.
You have a 90% chance of getting measles if you haven't been vaccinated and you come in contact with someone who has it.
So it's very infectious. And so it will find everybody who is not protected against measles.
The solution is to get 2 doses of the measles vaccine. That may mean educating parents about the disease and the vaccine. Equally important is making vaccination a priority of health systems worldwide. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, plugging in your next ride. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. VOA Asia Weekend continues. Ford is showing off its new fleet of electric vehicles. Some of the standouts include a new hybrid plug-in and the promise of a new all-electric model by 2022. The U.S. automaker plans to have a fleet of 40 different electric vehicles on the roads in the next 3 years. VOA's Kevin Enox reports.
Ford believes the future of driving is electric. These cars are all new releases from the Ford Motor Company, and they are all either fully electric or hybrid, a combination of internal combustion and electric. They will help drivers comply with the low emission zones being imposed in European cities. These areas charge drivers a fee for driving high emission cars, but this new fleet will let you drive free of charge.
You can save with just a touch of a button the electric energy in the battery and use the internal combustion engine to drive the car to London. And then you enter the borders of London, and then you can switch on electric, and the car drives emission-free in the city environment.
Ford's most popular car in Europe is the Transit, and the company has slowly been moving the car away from internal combustion and towards hybrids. Ford Europe Chairman Steve Armstrong says his company is ready to get these cars on the road.
We've had a fleet trial running in London for the last 12 months with 16 of our customers. And using the lessons we've learned from that fleet trial, we're actually going to go into full production later this year. And people will be able to see those vehicles on the streets across Europe by the end of this year.
A fully electric version will hit the streets in 2021.
All of the technologies are new. It's the latest generation of battery technology. It's the latest generation of e-motor technology. And then, of course, it's the latest generation of technologies mating the electric motors via the transmissions to the engines.
Ford says it is developing a fully electric passenger van with a range of 150 kilometers and a sports car with a 600 kilometer range. And those will be available 2020. Armstrong says they are just doing what's necessary to compete in a world that is increasingly mandating climate consciousness.
Electrification, of course, is going to be a very big part of our industry as we move to new types of propulsion to lower our CO2 emissions primarily. So you'll see more electrification news coming from us in the future. Next year, we will have our first full electric, which is a Mustang-inspired performance SUV.
To support the cars, a consortium of car companies is working to open 400 charging stations across Europe by next year. Kevin Enochs, VOA News.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, scientists in Israel have revealed what they say is the world's first 3D-printed heart using human tissue. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us the hope is a small heart will pave the way for transplants without donors when every hospital might have access to 3D organ printers.
The 3D heart includes, for the first time, cells, blood vessels, ventricles, and chambers. Produced by researchers at Tel Aviv University, the tiny heart is the size of a rabbit's. But Professor Tal Dvir says it is a scientific breakthrough.
This is the first time that the whole cellular heart with blood vessel is printed. And another major breakthrough is that it is printed from the materials of the patient itself.
The team reprogrammed cells taken from a small biopsy to become stem cells and then differentiated them to become cardiac cells and cells that form blood vessels.
And the biomaterial, the collagen and the other sugars that in the tissue is processed to become a bioink. And together, when mixed, we have bioinks for the heart and bioinks for the blood vessels. And then we use a 3D printer to print whole hearts with the major blood vessels.
It takes 3 hours to print one heart, measuring about 2.5 centimeters. Doctoral student Adav Noor says it will take several years of technological development before they can create a full-size, functional, pumping heart.
I'm not sure it's going to serve ourselves in the next few years, but for our children, I think it's going to be maybe an amazing opportunity, especially for heart disease patients.
The researchers hope that in 10 years, every hospital will own printers that can make tissues and organs to be transplanted into patients. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The Voice of America, VOA.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Scientists say cutting greenhouse gas emissions is not enough to prevent the worst impact of climate change. We need to be pulling carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere out of it. One of the best ways to do that is also one of the oldest Earth Day rituals, planting trees. Students, activists, and ordinary people have done this for Earth Day observances. Major corporations have signed on to an initiative to plant 100 million trees around the world by the year 2022. Even oil giant Shell has pledged $300 million over the next 3 years to a major reforestation effort. A project in the eastern United States is working to restore forests to mountains of Appalachia scarred by decades of coal mining. VOA's Steve Barragona grows our story.
Deep within West Virginia's Monongahela National Forest lies a rare stand of virgin woods.
Living in the East, there's not many places that you can go and be untouched by man.
Shane Jones is a biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. He says a mapping mistake spared these trees when the surrounding forest was logged decades ago. That's good, because red spruce forests like this one excel at taking planet-warming carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and locking it away in the soil.
See all that organic material?
It's black because it's incredibly high in carbon.
The mountains of Appalachia have lost 90% of their red spruce forests to logging and coal mining. Burning that coal for energy is adding more and more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. As the planet warms, scientists say the need for forests to remove that CO2 is increasingly urgent. The University of Kentucky's Chris Barton says tropical rainforests get the most attention.
But here in the temperate region of the world, in Appalachia, 4 hours away from Washington, D.C., we have billions of trees that potentially we could be planting.
Where better, Barton says, than here on the remains of old strip mines? That's one reason Barton started a group called Green Forests Work, to put trees back on the roughly 400,000 hectares of Appalachian forests that have been strip mined away. But there's a problem with many of these lands.
If you went out and planted trees on these sites, they just didn't grow. The ground was way too, compacted. Water didn't infiltrate. Roots can't penetrate. Oxygen can't circulate in those environments.
The solution looks more like a Game of Thrones battleground than a forest in the making. Ripping up the compacted ground will let the trees they plant put down roots. They're starting to see results. Forests are coming back on the grounds they've ripped up and replanted. Around the world, experts say, nature offers powerful tools to fight climate change. Nature works slowly, they say, but it works. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Elkins, West Virginia.
VOA Asia Weekend continues with a look on the U.S. oil embargo on Iran. Jim Stevenson has more.
Oil prices reached a six-month high Tuesday after the Trump administration announced it would no longer exempt countries from U.S. sanctions if they continue to buy Iranian crude oil, a move aimed at imposing a complete oil embargo on Iran. Waivers granted to eight countries, including big Iranian crude importers, China, India, Japan, Turkey, and South Korea, are due to expire May 2nd. The move would tighten oil supplies as seasonal demand picks up in the Northern Hemisphere, forcing importers to seek alternative supplies, a search made more challenging with production falling off in Venezuela and Libya because of domestic unrest and conflict. Iran was swift to respond, threatening to close the strategic Strait of Hormuz, a major shipment artery in the Middle East, if it cannot export oil. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more reaction from the countries most affected by the U.S. action, including China and Turkey.
The United States is no longer granting any exemptions from U.S. sanctions on Iranian oil imports. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the new policy Monday, saying that after giving countries time to reduce their imports of Iranian oil, the U.S. is going to zero.
Look, with the announcement today, we've made clear our seriousness of purpose. We are going to zero. How long we remain there at zero depends solely on the Islamic Republic of Iran's senior leaders. We've made our demands very clear to the Ayatollah and his cronies. End your pursuit of nuclear weapons. Stop testing and proliferating ballistic missiles. Stop sponsoring and committing terrorism. Halt the arbitrary detention of U.S. citizens.
Iran responded defiantly, threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz, a strategically important choke point, if it is prevented from using it to sell its oil. Turkey also rejected the U.S. move, with Ankara's foreign minister tweeting, "The U.S. decision to end sanctions waivers on Iran oil imports will not serve regional peace and stability, yet will harm the Iranian people." Turkey rejects unilateral sanctions and impositions on how to conduct relations with neighbors. China had a similar reaction, with a foreign ministry spokesman saying China opposes the U.S. imposition of unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction. Analysts warn the oil crackdown could provoke a showdown between the U.S. and Iran and could imperil U.S. trade talks with China. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Jonas Nam, Assistant Professor of Energy, Resources, and Environment at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington, spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman about how this latest move by the U.S. government affects Iran's biggest oil customer, China.
There's sort of a short-term and a long-term problem here, right? And the short-term problem is to try to satisfy the Trump administration's demands that are just incredibly abrupt and are asking them to make significant changes in a time frame that's going to make it very difficult for any of these countries to really shift their oil supply In the long run, of course, there are ambitious renewable energy programs, ambitious programs to shift away from fossil fuels more broadly that are ongoing in many parts of the world. And so that may, in the long run, relax oil markets globally, but it's not something that will really change things by the end of the year or even maybe by, you know, the end of the decade.
Did this catch the world by surprise, do you think?
I think when the moratorium was released last year, there was sort of an expectation that this would probably continue for a longer time. I think there's been an unusual obsession with Iran in the Trump administration that's catching many analysts by surprise. And so the sort of intensity with which the Trump administration is taking this issue on, I think, has surprised many and has certainly defied expectations.
So what do you suppose might happen? How much does China rely on Iranian oil?
Iranian oil is about 6% of China's domestic consumption.
But it's still Iran's biggest market, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Now, what happens now? China has been moving forward, as we understand it, in the field of sustainable energy. Is that enough to offset at least some of the loss of the whatever Iranian oil they're taking?
Well, it's unlikely to offset that in the next 2 weeks. And so I think it's really the time frame here that's making it difficult. We also have, you know, already trouble in Venezuela. Libya is not producing. So oil markets are tight, and Iran now dropping out of the picture is making it more difficult to shift to other sources.
Is this going to have, do you think, an effect on the ongoing trade talks? How much is this going to hurt China?
I could see that the Trump administration might anticipate that they can use the trade talks to pressure China into using other sources, but I can also see China maybe reducing its imports from Iran, but actually continuing to import and defying the U.S. in this situation. I think China is certainly going to try to separate the trade conversation from the oil conversation in this current situation.
How important is oil to the Chinese economy?
China's been importing oil, so its domestic production was insufficient starting in 1993. So it's been importing oil for a very long time. Since 2013, it's been the world's largest importer of oil, and so it doesn't have sufficient resources domestically. And so it's been strategically developing resources around the world and importing to grow its domestic economy.
But more and more, maybe you could explain how China is trying to develop its sustainable energy program.
Right. China is one of the world's largest investors in renewable energy, for instance, but that doesn't really directly compete with oil, since that is primarily for power generation. China doesn't produce any power domestically from oil, or at least not a significant China also is pushing aggressively into electric vehicles at the moment. So in the long run, we could see some changes there. China now has basically adopted the California zero emissions vehicle system, where you have certain quotas that car manufacturers need to meet in terms of sales of electric vehicles for their domestic fleet. And so China is trying very much to get away from fossil fuels, also because of its air pollution situation domestically. But none of these measures are likely to be able to offset the oil imports from Iran, at least not in this very, very short time frame.
Are you able to speak about South Korea and maybe some of the other Asian nations, maybe India, maybe Taiwan?
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with their kind of domestic political situation, but I think they all face a similar global picture in these oil markets, right? So oil markets are tight as they are. We've had a lot of issues in other parts of the world, and so there isn't much capacity for them to shift into. And so I think it's going to lead to rising prices at a time when the world economy is slumping a little bit. This is certainly not a good situation for them either.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Jonas Nam, Assistant Professor of Energy, Resources, and Environment at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Sri Lanka's Prime Minister says the suicide bombings that devastated the country on Easter Sunday could have links to Islamic State, which has claimed responsibility. Another official indicated that the bombings were in retaliation for last month's attacks on mosques in New Zealand. On Tuesday, Sri Lanka observed the National Day of Mourning as the death toll climbed to 321. Australia says its counterterrorism officers from the federal police will help Sri Lanka with its investigation into the Easter Sunday bombings. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Attacks on churches and hotels in Sri Lanka killed more than 300 people and wounded hundreds of others. Most of the victims were Sri Lankans, including many Christians, who were attending Easter Sunday church services. Sri Lanka's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has identified 31 foreign nationals among the dead, with more than a dozen unaccounted for. The victims included several British and Indian citizens. Three children of a Danish business tycoon also died, along with an Australian mother and her 10-year-old daughter. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
Two Australians have lost their lives in this terrible massacre, and my just heart is full of grief for them and their families, as I'm sure all Australians are.
Prime Minister Morrison says officers from the Australian Federal Police, the AFP, will be sent to Sri Lanka to help authorities track down the attackers. The AFP has experience in international terrorist atrocities and played a key role in the investigation of the bombings on the Indonesian resort island of Bali in October 2002. More than 200 people were killed, including 88 Australians. Lal Wickremutunga, Sri Lanka's Consul General in Sydney, says Australian expertise will be important.
We welcome the support of the Australian Prime Minister. Australia has always been a close ally of Sri Lanka. It is yet not known as to what level of support. Well, I believe they would offer a full gamut of things. Recently, we had 1,000 defence personnel in Sri Lanka, so Australia-Sri Lanka ties are very strong.
Police in Sri Lanka arrested 24 suspects in a series of raids just hours after the attacks. A jihadist group, the National Tawhid Jamaat, is thought to be behind the atrocities. It's emerged that Sri Lankan authorities were previously warned about the organisation accused of Sunday's bombings. US media has reported that both American and Indian security agencies had alerted Sri Lanka about a threat earlier this month. However, reports say neither Sri Lanka's Prime Minister nor members of his cabinet were informed. The US State Department has warned of possible further attacks in a travel advisory. Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
Thanks for tuning in to VOA Asia Weekend. For most people, learning a different language is a choice. But for students at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, learning how to communicate in their selected region is a requirement. VOA's Sahar Majid spoke to students in SAIS who are studying how to read and write in Urdu and Hindi as part of their South Asian concentration.
My name is Chloe Howenstein, and I'm from Utah.
Chloe Hounstein is a master's degree student at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. She's specializing in international development and finance.
5 years ago, through a critical language scholarship program, I went to India to learn Urdu, where I studied Urdu all day for 2 months.
For many students at the school, known by its acronym SAIS, learning a foreign language can be challenging.
Urdu is a difficult language. I am weak in spelling and grammar, but speaking and listening skills are relatively easy.
Well, Father Hussein has been teaching Urdu and Hindi at SAIS for 7 years.
So, Adam, Adam.
These Urdu-Hindi classes are mandatory for students majoring in South Asian studies.
Some people learn Urdu and Hindi because it's a job requirement. Some people learn because their family members speak Urdu or Hindi and they want to improve their communication with them.
Seema Hassan's father is from Pakistan, but she was born in the U.S.
Growing up, like I said, I was exposed to Pakistani culture, so my father never spoke to me in Urdu. But I was always curious about learning more about my Pakistani identity.
Many SAIS graduates end up pursuing global careers, so students there understand the importance of these foreign language classes.
World peace ke liye aur hamare global society ke liye.
It's important for world peace and our global society to understand each other.
Samajh sakte hain.
For Sahar Majid in Washington, D.C., Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
The Voice of America.
VOA Asia Weekend continues with an update on the situation in Sri Lanka. With more on that, here is Ira Melman.
We're happy you're with us. Sri Lanka's president shook up that country's top security establishment after officials failed to act on intelligence reports warning of possible attacks before the Easter bombings that killed over 350 people. Government leaders have acknowledged that some intelligence units were aware of possible attacks weeks before the bombings that struck three churches and three luxury hotels. The death toll rose Wednesday to 359, with 500 people wounded. A police spokesman also said 18 suspects were arrested overnight, raising that total detained to 58. I spoke via Skype with Michael Kugelman, the deputy director of the Asia program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center for Scholars here in Washington. He said governmental dysfunction most likely led to the reason why that information was not communicated.
There's been a long-standing political crisis and a dispute between the president and the prime minister. And at one point last year, the president essentially tried to remove the prime minister from power. The Supreme Court reinstated him, but they continue to spar. And one of the consequences of this long-standing dispute is that the prime minister has really been cut off. His access has really been cut off to a lot of high-level discussions and business and activities. And I think in the case of these intelligence reports, you had the prime minister and those close to him who basically were not privy to all of these intelligence reports. Now, that raises the question, well, okay, the prime minister didn't know about them, but the president apparently did. Even though he claims he did not, there's good reason to think that he did. So I think that the president has tried to prevent the prime minister from being involved in a lot of key high-level activities and has been cut off from a lot of information. And that includes these intelligence reports. The prime minister has claimed that if he had known about all of these reports warning of these attacks, he would have acted immediately. Now, we don't know if that's the case for sure, but I think it really comes down to divisions within the government, dysfunction, and that really poses as a distraction. So clearly that's going to deepen the anger and the unhappiness of the prime minister, and will make this relationship between the two top leaders of Sri Lanka even more difficult. Unfortunately, though, this is the time where these two leaders need to set aside the toxicity in their relationship and find a way to move forward, because obviously Sri Lanka is in an extremely delicate state right now. It suffered this incredibly unprecedented catastrophic attack, and there's very real concerns that there could be reprisal attacks on Muslims, and that all of these long-standing ethnic divides and religious divides in Sri Lanka, which have really been under the surface, suppressed in the years since the civil war ended, that those could explode once again. And you need a united government to try to come out there and unite a country that is not only grieving, but also understandably very angry that their government essentially let them down in a huge way with tragic consequences.
The capital of Colombo, meanwhile, remained rattled by reports that police were continuing to conduct controlled detonations of suspicious items 3 days after the attacks on churches and hotels. And the U.S. ambassador said that Washington believes the terrorist plotting is ongoing.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Journal of the American Medical Association released two new studies that examine the sedentary lifestyle in the U.S. One study led by the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis suggests that between 2007 and 2016, time spent sitting among American teenagers rose from 7 hours to a little over 8 hours a day, and 5.5 hours to nearly 6.5 hours per day for adults. The other paper from Johns Hopkins Medicine, which studied physical activity of women with cardiovascular disease, found that more than half weren't as physically active as they should have been. They added that the number of the inactive women had increased over the past decade. Sedentary lifestyles have been linked to higher risks of diseases and conditions such as cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Voice of America.
Thank you for staying with us on VOA Asia Weekend. For Ira Melman, I'm Ari Arafin in Washington, D.C. We'll see you again next week, and we hope you have a wonderful weekend.